the upper hand. When you consider something that that I have introduced in the thousand-year conspiracy. I mean, it sounds like a corny title. You talk about the thousand-year conspiracy. You're going to send most political intellectuals to rolling their eyes. You're going to go, oh, yeah, right, a thousand-year conspiracy. Uh-huh, sure. Well, I don't know about a thousand years, but when, for example, you take that book from 1943, The Thousand-Year Conspiracy by Paul Winkler, and it talks about the theories of Friedrich von Liszt, who was a Prussian economic theorist, who in the 1840s, advocated as a tactic, as a stratagem, that Germany establish a pan-European economic union under German domination as a vehicle for effecting first economic and then political domination over the rest of the world. This is what you're seeing now. That was the 1840s, but now you're seeing that with the European Union. This is going to begin at the end of next year. The Deutschmark is going to disappear. And it is going to have a profound effect on the world economy and world political situation. And with that European Economic Union dominated by Germany and the European Monetary Institution located in Frankfurt, institutions or treaties like GATT are going to assume a very much larger and more sinister place in our lives than I think they already do. But basically, GATT permits a globalization of the corporate state, and with Europe, a unified, an economically unified Europe under German domination, now obviously being one of the major elements in this world corporate state, I think they're going to be able to dictate American life to Americans to an enormous extent. What's interesting is to see the extent to which the German core corporations are already buying up not only the United States, but other countries around the world. You take a look at energy, for example, publishing, communications. I mean, if you're going to write a book and get it published in the United States, the odds are excellent that if it's going to be published by a major publisher, it's going to be published by a German-dominated publisher. I mean, Dell, Random House, New York Times books. Not New York Times, but so many of these, the major publishers now are owned by Bertelsmann or one of the other major German publishers. The German core corporations are wield a profound influence in American economic life, and yet in Germany, it is illegal for a foreign corporation to own a controlling interest in any major German firm. Yet German core corporations own controlling interests in many American companies. I don't know if you noticed that Siemens just bought out Westinghouse. They didn't buy out their nuclear power division, but Siemens just bought Westinghouse. The Dow Jones Corporation and Wall Street Journal have a large capital participation by Die Welt, one of the most reactionary German publications. It is a very interesting state of affairs, and the German core corporations have cabinet ministers sitting in on their directors' meetings, the board of directors' meetings, and in turn, the members of the board of directors sit in on German government cabinet ministers. It is a national socialist economy, as Hitler envisioned it. Not socialist, but the ultimate in capitalism, in which the corporate state, as Mussolini termed his system of fascism, has its ultimate manifestation, and this is what we're seeing internationally. So I think the dominant element in the world today, the dominant dynamic, is the struggle, if indeed there still is a struggle, for control of the capitalist, industrialized world between Germany and the United States. I personally believe that struggle has already been resolved behind the scenes in favor of Germany. Then if one factors in, for example, such things as the Bormann Organization, which has an enormous worldwide influence and is also tied to the German core corporations, the landmark book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, discusses the fact that no major corporate decisions are made in any of the German core corporations. I'm talking about Bayer, BASF, Mercedes, Porsche, Mannesmann, Siemens. No decisions are made in any of those corporations without checking with the NSDAP leadership in Latin America, the old Nazi hierarchy, now with a second generation raised up. So that German-dominated European Union that Friedrich von Liszt was advocating in the 1840s is now a reality. And it is dominated by a corporate structure within Germany, which is at one with its political structure, and which in turn is controlled behind the scenes, as it has been from World War II onward, by the NSDAP underground, by the Nazi Party in exile underground, controlled by the Bormann Group. That's a very unappetizing prospect to contemplate, and I guess, and using a gross pun, but that government governs best that governs least, you know, punning on Friedrich Liszt. But so in terms of what's going on in the former Soviet Union, I believe that the former Soviet Union is going to be dominated by Germany if it isn't already. They're already buying up a lot of very, very important areas of the former East Bloc. And I predict ultimately that Russia itself will go fascist and will be allied with Nazi Germany as part of a newly Nazified Germany. In fact, never effectively denazified Germany as part of the entity which is going to dominate the world. I believe that the United States as a world power is already in decline behind the scenes, very much like when the Spanish battalions set forth for the 30 Years' War. I mean, their glittering banners shown all over Europe, but already Spain was in decline. And I believe, too, that the American century has come and passed, and I believe we are a power in decline. And I believe that in the 21st century, we will be little more than a German colony and a tree farm for Japan. I believe our huge military will, in effect, serve like the Gurkhas, that will be the head crackers for the multinational corporations, which will in turn be dominated by the German corporations. And I believe that the next century will be the German century. I don't see much of a prospect of communism coming back to the Soviet Union. Now, maybe I'm wrong. You know, I'm not a prophet, but I think in terms of economic control, it looks to me like economically, Russia has already, and the former Soviet Union has already, rushed headlong into a laissez-faire corporatist economy with very strong organized crime input as well. If there were to be any kind of revival of the communist structure, I would tend to think that it would come in a corrupt and semi-underground form from some of the Russian mafia, because much of the Russian mafia, quote-unquote, that we're hearing about are former Russian military intelligence and KGB people who just got into the crime business with their very formidable credentials after the dissolution of the Cold War. The thing is that the combination of technology and capital has been a huge brain drain in the former Soviet Union. A lot of their engineering people have already left. I don't know where the capital would come from that could possibly fuel a resurgence of communism in Russia. Maybe there would be a second revolution if things got rotten enough there. I don't know. But the administration of power in the former Soviet Union does not appear to me to be really comparable with the way power was aligned in Weimar Germany, in which you had a superficial democracy, but the power structures were held by the same industrialist financiers and junkers and aristocrats that had held power under the Kaiser. And then with some of the corporate connections that had developed during the 1920s, they simply proceeded from that point. I don't see, and again I'm limited in terms of my understanding from what we get from our media, which is baloney. You know, I mean, we're handed a bunch of nonsense. You turn on the television, you know, and you turn on CBS, and that's what you see is BS. You know, we don't get the truth. So I don't see where the power would come from to do that, because if there were to be a resurgence of the Communist Party, a real resurgence inside of Russia, I think that the same forces which brought it down in the first place, both internal and external, I think the same shortcomings of the Soviet system that helped collapse it in the first place, plus the same external forces that helped to collapse it from the outside, would coalesce in a hurry in order to do the same thing. I just don't see that happening. Perhaps I'm wrong. Remains to be seen. Anybody else? Yes, sir. I don't, now if I'm understanding you correctly, are you saying, do I see China somehow and the U.S. as being in a position to block the European Union or the functions of it? Yeah. I don't think at this point Clinton is really in charge of the United States. I don't think Clinton has a clue, frankly. I really don't. I mean, this is not to find fault with Clinton as an individual. I think the pressures on him are so enormous at this point. And Clinton really is not running the country. The Republican Congress is running the country. And they're blocking Clinton's court appointments, for example. Most of his federal judicial appointments have been blocked. They're blocking foreign policy, economic policy. One of the things, when the New York Times editorial people, when the New York Times op-ed writers begin inveighing against the Republican Congress, that is the voice of the more liberal elements of the national security establishment and the elite. New York Times was revealed by the Pike Committee to be the CIA's number one propaganda asset. And that says to me that some in the corridors of power are beginning to become alarmed at what's going on. In particular, I believe it was Anthony Lewis was writing about how the Republicans had blocked any American monies that were to be contributed to the International Monetary Fund, whose activities are viewed as absolutely essential for shoring up some of the weakened economies in Asia. And if those economies continue to weaken and if they go down, it could have a profoundly destabilizing effect on the capital markets. You know, the Wall Street shakeups that took place a couple of weeks ago are likely to be not only perpetuated but repeated in drastic fashion. If the IMF is not in a position to help out some of those now weakened capitalist economies in Asia, it could have a catastrophic effect on the global economy. And this is one of the things that the Times writer was talking about. You know, the Republicans are playing partisan politics with something that could destroy the world economy, and that is not an intelligent way of doing things. So I don't personally see Bill Clinton as anything more than a relatively unimportant figure on the scene today. I don't think that he was ever really the most powerful element in Washington. One of the important things about studying history is to understand what has really taken place, and the President of the United States does not wield that much power. And President JFK found that out the hard way. Others have learned the same lesson in less dramatic fashion. Richard Nixon found that out, and he was a player in all of these scenarios that I've talked about. He was Alan Dulles' right-hand man for the Crusade for Freedom. And yet, when he tried to dissolve the intelligence establishment and set up one giant intelligence agency, when he tried to establish detente with China and with the Soviet Union, he got booted out. I mean, Watergate was a coup d'etat. He was eased out in a relatively bloodless fashion. And Teddy Roosevelt's long gone. Teddy Roosevelt was the architect of the, quote, trust-busting, unquote, program, which was a farce. What it was, it ostensibly, it did break up things like the Standard Oil Trust, as I explained earlier, but instead of having it broken up into a bunch of different companies that were competing, it broke it up into a bunch of different companies that were all owned by the same people, which did the same thing. So Teddy Roosevelt, he tried his hand at reforming things, and he did a few good things. He helped set up our national park system, for example. But already, I think, by the beginning of this century, I think the real power in this country was national security power rather than and economic power rather than the power of the office of the President of the United States. My own opinion is that in addition to the assassinations we know about, I'm very suspicious about the deaths of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt and Warren Harding. Wilson had been a champion of including the Soviet Union in the family of nations. He died of, I think it was the flu or something, he died a rather strange death right after doing that. Warren Harding died in very strange circumstances when the Teapot Dome scandal broke. And Franklin Roosevelt died under strange circumstances right as World War II was drawing to a close. And Roosevelt had been proposing what was known as a banker's trial. He was at Nuremberg. He was going to have many of the top German industrialists and financiers name their American and British co-conspirators in the dock at Nuremberg. They were then going to be indicted. If Franklin Roosevelt had lived, I mean, you know, it could have, woulda, coulda, shoulda, had a thing, but if Franklin Roosevelt had lived, you would have seen names like Rockefeller, DuPont, Mellon, Morgan indicted at Nuremberg, and we would have a very different understanding of history than the one we have now. In other words, it wouldn't be, you know, some weird SOB like Dave Emery sitting up here lecturing at Foothill College at this hour about all this weird stuff. It would be known. It would be taught in our college textbooks. It would be taught in our high school textbooks instead of being this arcane awareness. But I think it's important to understand the president doesn't wield that much power. And I think Clinton has been no more than a lily pad approaching a waterfall almost from the beginning. He was not viewed with great favor when he came into power. And I think his opening up of the military to gays or his attempt to do that was suicidal in terms of a political move. And this is not to pass judgment on it. And again, I'm not concerned with people's genitals, and I could care less whether they're gays in the military or anything else. There always have been, there always will be. And I certainly have nothing against that, but for Clinton to take a relatively unimportant issue, which that is, and to lead with his chin, I mean, the military already distrusted Clinton, and then for him to use that as sort of a signpost, maybe 2 or 3 days after being elected, what he was doing was waving a red flag at the most powerful and deadly institution in our society, and I suspect that's had much to do with some of the things that have gone on behind the scenes in his administration. I don't see Clinton as being able to block it, no. I don't even think he knows how. Currently, I don't know how. I don't know how you would go about doing it. I think things have reached a relatively advanced state, and I think that it rather in terms than thinking in terms of some sort of grand move that could be made on the international power political stage by some saint, somebody or other, Saint William or somebody else, I think rather it's important to understand the profound influence that these forces have on our lives, that, you know, when you're going to go to a store to pick up food or medicine or a product, that the people that we're talking about, the people that funded fascism, the people that brought fascism, are the people who make your products. And that this is the food and the water and the medicines that are going into your bodies and the bodies of your children, and that these are the people who are determining the future for you. I think rather in terms of counteracting, I think it's going to be a gradual process. And it's going to take a long time, and it's going to require effort by each of us. Anybody else? First this gentleman, and then you. You first, yeah. I don't know. I mean, there is some discontent. I don't know how effectively that is likely to be expressed in terms of the formation of a third party or a fourth party or a fifth party. I don't think that's an effective way of doing it, simply because I think it's too late in the day, and I think a much more effective way of expressing that would be to organize within, say, the Democratic Party, because it does have a structure. Really, when you examine our electoral system, it's built for two parties. I do think that there is dissatisfaction on the part of quite a few people with the corporate state, to use the term that Mussolini applied to his fascist state. But I don't know, honestly, how many people really understand corporate power and its abuses. You know, this is sort of the view from the street level, and I really can't give you any kind of definitive analysis. I wouldn't presume to speak for the American people. I don't know how many people really understand corporate control or how corporations operate or the extent to which they have come to operate. I certainly know that some people understand GATT and NAFTA. Some people understand transnational corporations. But as a lifelong blue-collar worker, you know, what I've seen from fellow workers, you know, is for the most part ignorance of how things really operate. Just in 1996, my roommates, I mean, they're very nice people. This is not to speak against them. He's an engineer who repairs medical equipment in the Bay Area. She's a nursing student at De Anza. But they didn't vote. And, you know, I was watching the returns and cussing out the TV when I saw that the Republicans were going to retain control of Congress, because it meant basically more of the same. A do-nothing Bill Clinton with, you know, Newt Gingrich grandstanding away and running against, you know, wealthy, you know, the sort of standard generic Republican enemy, you know, the immigrant welfare mother on drugs, you know. I mean, it's just that's kind of what the Republicans have been running against. But they didn't vote, and I was trying to explain Congress, and they didn't know what Congress was. You know, they didn't understand, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate. They had no idea what these things were or how they operated. And these are two relatively educated and intelligent people. They appear to me to be relatively representative of the working people that I've dealt with. And this is not, and that leaving aside all the blue-collar workers I've dealt with. I mean, my years as, you know, construction worker, short-order cook, and what have you, I mean, Jesus, man, political kind, you know, awareness of them is, you know, hey, who's playing tonight? Oh, it's the Raiders and the Eagles. Oh, I don't like the Raiders. They got too many niggers on that team. Well, the Eagles got a lot of niggers on that team. Hey, Dave, who do you think has faster niggers, the Raiders or the Eagles? You know, I mean, that's about the level of political consciousness on an awful lot of them. And it's not in any way engaged in vulgarity. But I'm telling you, it's just expecting those people to understand corporate control. I mean, I haven't seen it. You know, but then again, I can't say that my experience at ground level, so to speak, my worm's eye view is necessarily representative. I certainly don't see much awareness in the media of that. Then again, our media are controlled. Here in the plastic, fantastic Silicon Valley, I don't see a lot of awareness of it. You know, I mean, everybody's looking to basically get their, make their pile of cash and get the hell out of here. So I'm not optimistic about alternative political solutions. On the other hand, there did appear to be quite a bit of sympathy for the UPS strike. A couple of years ago, I think it was Safeway struck against the supermarket chains. There appeared to be a lot of sympathy for that. I do think that X number of people in this country can understand some aspects of labor organization. On the other hand, I hear all this bad stuff about unions. I hear everybody ripping unions. And certainly unions can be corrupt, but in terms of American working people, I hear an awful lot of anti-union sentiment. And any kind of power can be abused, but I am fiercely pro-union. And unions are basically what got Americans an awful lot of what they take for granted today. They don't realize what things were like in 1910 or 1911. You know, you had a 60-hour work week. There was no workman's comp. There was no unemployment insurance. There was no nothing. You know, you worked 6 days a week. You worked 10 hours a day. There was no such thing as overtime pay. If you got your arm ripped off on a piece of machinery, you bloody well better hope you could find a job you did with one arm if you survived the injury. Otherwise, you took your one good arm and you wrapped it around a bottle of cheap wine and drank yourself to death in the gutter. I mean, life was brutal. And I see things in many ways moving back in that direction. And one of the problems globally is we are now, in the name of anti-communism, our national security establishment was used to jackhammer the hell out of all sorts of third world countries like Guatemala and the 54 coup. And really was not anti-communism that was the operant consideration, but corporatism. And these countries were being made safe for fascism. And now, even though some of the more overtly repressive features of some of these military governments in the third world have been lifted, now basically the American workforce and the workforce in much of the so-called first world is being pitted against these relative, what we could view as a captive labor force in the third world. And we're competing with each other for these manufacturing jobs. And to the low bidder is going to win to the detriment of everybody, both those who win and those who wind up losing. And so there's not going to be any sort of relatively fast or simple solution. I think, you know, I was talking outside with some of the members of the audience here. I was talking with a young fellow who asked a question just a couple of minutes ago, and I think if there's to be a satisfactory outcome to not only human but other life on Earth, I mean, this is a large perspective to take maybe, but I think people have to think in over the long term. I think people have to think about educating one another and their children in particular, because my own feeling is things have disintegrated to an incredibly high degree. I don't see anything happening quickly. And the thing that I find very scary and depressing is I find people wanting, if not immediate gratification, very, very quick gratification. And I'm afraid that the only satisfactory solution to things is going to be, people are going to have to defer gratification for their actions. If our actions are to have a positive effect, that effect isn't going to take place in all likelihood till long after our death, after each of us has died. And I don't think as a civilization or as a culture, we really have much of a concept of passing from one generation, of passing a significant legacy from one generation to the next. Our culture appears to me to be, to a large extent, atomized and serialized. We're individuals sitting in front of our television sets watching a bunch of hoo-ha and going out and buying the products or behaving in the fashion that that television tells us to. And I don't see a generational cultural continuity, a transgenerational cultural continuity, and that alone, I think, could restore some measure of decency or to establish a better world at some point. I do what I do. I mean, obviously, I'm hoping to affect things, but I'll tell you, I think that we are at a period in time when we are going to witness the apotheosis of our species and our planet. I think whatever the human experience on Earth, and in all probability, animal life on Earth was ever going to come to, or whatever was ever going to mean, if it was ever going to come to anything or mean anything, that the resolution to that is taking place right now, and I think it is likely to be not only bad, but awful and catastrophic beyond our understanding. But barring a drastic change, what we are going to see in the 21st century is a worldwide technologically based corporate theocracy in which will be dominated and run by and for the minions of Adolf Hitler, armed with 21st century technology. It's a very unappetizing prospect. I think that for the human experience on this earth to come to that, something as awful as one can possibly imagine, I think speaks very badly for all of us. And I think that if, as human beings, we have any sense of individual decency, any individual sense of self-respect, any individual sense of honor, I think we have to commit ourselves to not only fighting, to struggling, but resign ourselves to the inevitability that an awful lot of us aren't going to survive that struggle, that are going to be a lot of casualties, there will be an incredible amount of suffering, and that if that struggle is to be successful, the results will not become evident until long after our demise. Maybe our great-grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, might begin to enjoy some of the fruits of this. It would take a struggle of a magnitude and requiring a degree of selflessness that I cannot personally imagine, but I think it has to be done. And if it isn't done, then the human experience on Earth will have amounted to a prologue leading up to Hitler. And that just doesn't seem to me to be worth, to be something that we can endure or tolerate. And whatever sacrifices I think have to be made, and whatever has to be done, I think has to be done. As Winston Churchill said, sometimes it's not enough to do one's best. Sometimes one has to do what is necessary. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to do that. I think we have to set a course of individual action that is will necessarily place each of us individually at risk. I think we have to resign ourselves to the fact that many of us are going to lose our lives in that struggle. I think we also should understand that death is inevitable anyway. None of us gets off this world alive, and I think it's also important to understand that the best of our physical science has determined that there's far more than just the four dimensions that we experience with our senses. I don't know whether consciousness survives death or anything else, but it ain't just these. We experience height, width, depth, and time. And yet, physics has pretty much determined they're probably somewhere in the vicinity of 10 dimensions, which means the greater part of physical creation and physical reality is unknown to our senses. If there were a dog in here and I were to blow a dog whistle, none of you would hear it, but the dog would respond immediately. There are many things in the physical world that we are not aware of, and yet which do exist. And one of the things that has proved so intimidating and I think very destructive to our culture is the notion that all there is this stuff, and that all there is, you know, to me is this body here, and all there is to you is that body there. And again, I'm not going to engage in some sort of metaphysical lecture or religious sermon, but our science, that's pseudoscience, and our science has now determined that there's far more to that. And I got a hunch that whatever Homo sapiens' spiritual awareness, there's never been an atheistic culture. They all believe in something, whether it's, you know, Jesus or Buddha or Allah or the river god or the monkey god or all sorts of spirits. They all believe in something, and I suspect that just as animals have instincts, I think that is a function of Homo sapiens' instinctive awareness of the six or more dimensions that we do not experience with our senses. I think it's important as we contemplate our role in the present, which I see ideally as being able to set the table for a decent future for generations as yet unborn. It is going to require a great deal of selflessness. A lot of us are going to lose our lives. And I think in order to motivate ourselves to do that, I think it's important to understand that there is almost certainly far more than just this here. Because we ultimately are intimidated by the fear of death. Death is scary. You know, we are to become undone. And that's an awareness which I think has had a very destructive effect in the 19th and 20th centuries. Max Weber, the German sociologist, I think hit on something very important when he analyzed the demise of religion and the effect it has had on society. And I'm not, this is not in any way to engage in Bible thumping or to posit myself as some sort of holy roller, but I do think that if we are going to overcome what is taking place now, and if we don't overcome it, then I think, to use another quote of Winston Churchill's, then the world will be plunged into an abyss made more sinister by the knights of perverted science. Another description of Churchill's that I think applies to what's coming, barring a drastic change, was what he described in describing the Eastern Front in World War II. And most Americans have no idea what combat was like on the Eastern Front. He described it as a cataract of horrors. And that is what is going to befall us. When the economy goes in the tank, which it is going to do at some point. Probably when the euro kicks in, it is going to have some sort of profound effect. Then when the baby boomers start to retire in the beginning of the second decade of the next century, their spending is going to go down. They're going to be a burden on the economy because they're going to need medical care, and they're going to want to pay for that. There's going to be all these, the monkey viruses are going to come alive in their immune systems. They're going to have all these old, sick, non-working, non-spending, sick bags of flesh hanging around. They're going to want all these favors that the baby boomers have gotten used to, courtesy of the very big government they profess not to want. And something's going to have to give. And I think that, again, the world will be plunged into an abyss, made more sinister by the knights of perverted science. It's something worth sacrificing oneself for. Again, I'm not advocating that you go out and fling yourself on a sword. But at the same time, you ever see the movie The Life of Brian, the Monty Python film? It's quite a good movie. I don't generally like Monty Python. I don't like movies in general. Most comedies make me sick. But this is quite funny. At one point, you know, there's this guy named Brian, and they mistake him for some sort of deity. He's just a schmuck, right? But they were chasing him all around, and he's running to run away, and he loses a sandal. They go, look, his shoe, oh, it's a sign, it's a miracle. That's his damn shoe. But and at one point, he's being crucified and with these two thieves, and one boy says, look, we're saved. It's the Palestinian suicide commando, right? And they all run out, and they draw their swords, and they all commit suicide. Right? And they kill themselves. They don't get saved. So I'm not advocating to become the Palestinian suicide commando. But at the same time, you know, our forebears handed us a better world than the one we're going to hand to the next generations. I think that's something that's changed. You know, for a long time in this country, there was progress from one generation to the next, and the world as a whole, and now that's not taking place. Now, each generation is handing the next generation a more screwed-up world than the one they inherited. And that's really wicked, and I think it's counter-evolutionary in a way that we should feel a degree of shame. And if you don't feel shame just because of who you are, contemplate the fact that there almost is certainly something beyond the grave. I don't know what a consciousness survives a grave, you know, heaven, hell, reincarnation. I don't know, but the best science has been able to determine is that there are 10 dimensions. The string theory, which is what prevails now in physics and which to a certain extent has been experimentally proved by people like Stephen Hawking, maintains that there are these tiny building blocks of matter called strings, smaller than a proton, that they exist in a state of resonant harmony over 10 dimensions with black holes in space. Now, I don't know exactly what that means, you know. What it means to me is that it's a whole lot more than just Joe and his hot dog stand. And I think we should understand that, because we are basically intimidated into inaction, into self-absorption, into consumerism by the notion that all there is this and us and this stuff. And, you know, we better go out and buy all the toys we can and play with all the toys we can because we're going to die. I mean, it was this bumper sticker that was really popular in the 80s. It said, he who dies with the most toys wins. And I think that in many ways expresses the attitude we have to struggle against. I used to look at that one. I mean, how can anybody think that's great? Because there's always somebody with more toys than you are, you know, you have. But that, I think, in many ways is a product of false consciousness, and we're going to have to struggle against that. You know, and as horrible as a lot of this seems, it certainly doesn't set me to doing the varsity rag. At the same time, I think it's important to understand, you know, you're not going to live forever. You know, people say to me, you know, you shouldn't do it. You're going to get killed doing that. You think you're going to live forever, you know, with all the poisoned air and poisoned this, that, and go out and get your vaccine. Go out and get your flu vaccine made by, you know, IG Farben and the Mormon Organization. Great, you know, rock them. But, you know, it's important to understand that life ends in death anyway, and that there is almost certainly something beyond the grave. Again, I don't know what. You know, I seriously doubt it's some, you know, senile Judeo-Christian reality where you have some old senile guy with a long white beard sitting on a golden throne hurling lightning bolts at fornicators. That I doubt. But there is probably something. And I would think very seriously about being a passive member of the generation that allowed all of earthly creation to disintegrate. Because if the same principles apply through the other 10 dimensions that apply in Newtonian physics and these, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And if witnessing the demise of earthly creation, the expunging of all that is considered righteous and noble and beautiful in human existence, and that's what's going on now, and if you sit back idly and allow that to happen, I wouldn't bet that that idleness and that selfishness does not have consequences unforeseen in these four dimensions. That would not be consistent with physics and what we know about it. So I think you have to take the larger picture, and I think as horrible as a lot of this seems to be, and again, I certainly think it's pretty awful. At the same time, we're lucky. in that we are the generation globally, and that, you know, the generations alive now on Earth are the generations who are going to decide the fate of humanity. And in particular, with the technologies that are coming of age now, genetic engineering, cloning, the things they're doing with mind control. I don't know if you heard the most recent of the interviews that I did with Nick Begich. They are now, by the middle of the next century, they think they're going to be able to remove or implant any set of memory values at will. And it's basically like plugging a CD into a CD player. They can remove any part of your memory or personality at will and insert anything they want at will. So it's basically they will be able to genetically engineer whatever sort of creatures they want, and they will be able to program them psychologically using mind control in any fashion that they want to do. This, in many ways, transcends everything that has been viewed as essential to civilized life on this planet. In many ways, it transcends even our concept of ourselves as sentient, moral human beings. And I think that it is worth resisting. And I think that if it is not successfully resisted, even if all of these things come to pass, I think that when each of us passes through that narrow door, you know, I don't know what lies on the other side of it, but I think it's important to realize that there was almost certainly something on the other side of that door, that this is not just it. I ain't going to say what, I'm not going to give you a religious sermon on anything else. But what you're really doing is you're like at the gaming houses in Vegas. And if you say, well, this is it, I'm just going to struggle for all the goodies that I can and watch television and, you know, get my season tickets to the Niners game or whatever. If that's all you want in life, in one sense, I feel sorry for you. But in another sense, I think when you cross through that narrow door, you may be feeling much more sorry for yourself than I would at this point, because there's probably something more than that. And I think a certain sense of nobility helps, too. I mean, nobility might sound like a strange thing to say, but if as a human being, if you can resign yourself to allowing the whole world, not just for us, but for all the future generations, to go straight to hell, then I think you should be ashamed of yourself. And I don't see how a person could really live without awareness. But I think we can use that, the awareness that it's up to us now, here, as daunting a prospect as that is, to motivate ourselves to do it. Because on the other hand, granted, given the fact, and it is a fact, that there is something, what, I don't know, you know, I'm not saying consciousness survives death, there is something beyond these four dimensions. And in a positive sense, too, if you do shoulder the burden, and if you do make the sacrifice, even if you do not experience the positive results of your efforts, that, too, will have its component in the other six dimensions that we don't experience. And so I think we have to do that. But, boy, I'm sure not real optimistic about any short-term political developments that I see. That's a nice, succinct answer to your question, isn't it? A couple things, as we're winding right down to the tail end of the discussion here. I very much appreciate your coming here, and I very much appreciate the $10 that you kicked in to get here. I will take questions while this is going around, but we are nearing the conclusion of the talk here. I'm yours for the duration of the evening, as long as we can stay here and before the coaches turn into pumpkins and the mice and the horses into mice. I'm yours here. So any other questions, comments, anything else? Gentleman here, he has not asked a question before or made a comment.
What do you do when you're
speaking on the air? I do voiceovers for the interactive touch-tone telephone service, and I try to keep my sanity, and I go to libraries and I read, and it's a daily. I live a very, very unremarkable existence. It's funny, people wonder, well, what do you do, you know? Push-ups, the blue tango, you know. I mean, it's a pretty unexciting existence. You know, the thrust of what I do is the research. I mean, I live to do the work, you know, the research and the broadcasting. And I have a day job, and I don't have a whole lot that they could take away from me. It's not to say that I'm whistling through the graveyard, but you know, I see the contribution that I can make to civilization as this, you know, and it's a skill that I have that, you know, maybe others don't. I don't know. It's not to say that I'm in any way better than anybody else. I think a lot of the impact that this material has, it's not due to anything directly to do with me, but rather it's what I said earlier. It's the power of the truth itself and the fact that we've been lied to, and we don't know where the CIA comes from or what all this stuff does. And so that when somebody starts putting this together for us, in this case, me, as it happens, it has an impact that resonates within each of us. It's one of the reasons why I think the string theory probably has implications far larger than what most people would be inclined to suspect. I think that's what happens when I do a program that people find very interesting. You notice that the Unabomber, Mr. Kaczynski, is all worried about having a government psychiatric exam. He's afraid he's going to be placed under mind control. It's interesting because that's actually in the Chronicle today. I was saying, what? You know, 1997 and mind control is in the news. You know, you never hear about that. But I think an awful lot of this has to do with... why don't we do this? I'll circulate this here. I think an awful lot of the impact of a program, of the program of the research, has to do with the fact that we've been lied to and we have not had the connections drawn. There was like, hopefully the, granted there was a long lecture this evening, but hopefully, and by the way, this was taped and will be available from Spitfire. If you were in attendance, thank you very much, by the way, you were very, very generous. If you were in attendance at the lecture, contact Spitfire and tell them that you were at the lecture. And I will tell Spitfire to do it just for cost and also shipping, obviously, rather than making profit. I have no direct control of them, but if you would like a copy of the lecture tonight, contact Spitfire, and they will do it for cost plus shipping, just the cost of the cassettes. But the impact of a program like this, do you have something there that people could write on? Here's a pen and something.
The impact of a lecture like this is that we've been lied to a large extent,
and yet reality, political reality, is knowable. I don't think it's all that difficult to figure this stuff out if the facts are made plain to people, you know? And the fact of the matter is we get lied to, but people have existed for X amount of time, and they understand networking. That's why I repeated that term so many times. You know, again, people say conspiracy, you know, yeah, I don't want to hear about conspiracies, but networking, that's what happens all the time. And that's what this is. I have these people, you know, you have old Dickie Helms, you know, taking over from Alan Dulles in the OSS Berlin section, and his grandfather, Gates McGarrah, ran the damn BIS, and all these, it's networking, and it's an elite, and it really is not mysterious, and I think it's relatively easy to understand when the veil is lifted from our eyes. And I think the impact this stuff has is sort of like the light bulb, you know, aha, you know, when you hear the truth, you recognize it, and it may not set you free like that cliche has it, but it certainly is the first step if you're ever going to get free, because you got to have the truth. But I think that's my role in this thing as I see it, and I don't think there's anything better or more worthwhile or more noble that I could possibly do with my existence such as it is. It's one of the reasons I'd like to free myself up from working. I think the best contribution I could make to society is this. I don't think, you know, if I have to schlep, you know, any one of the number of blue-collar jobs or even doing voiceovers. I mean, voiceovers are so, I mean, it pays fairly well. But, oh, God, is that uninteresting, you know, selling hemorrhoid medicine and shit like that. I mean, that just doesn't cut it at all. I mean, I have a hard time sometimes. I've yet to start doing ads where you get really expensive residuals. I got a hunch I might be blacklisted out of that. Certainly, if you want to make it in the corporate world, doing what I do is not what you want to do. It's not a good way to vault into corporate society. But when doing my mundane voiceover job, you know, I do these little promos for an interactive touch-tone telephone system. And, oh, boy, I have a hard time keeping a straight face for some of this stuff. You know, it really is, it's funny. You know, dinosaurs are all the thing now. All the amusement parks and everything. Everybody's doing a dinosaur thing these days. Maybe it's because we're preparing ourselves to become extinct. But and it was doing some Marine World Africa USA the other day, and they said, you can't visit Jurassic Park. I just have to write the scripts for this thing. You know, you can't visit Jurassic Park, but you can visit the next best thing. Marine World Africa USA's Dinosaurs, a Prehistoric Adventure. With over 28 roaring, robotic, life-size dinosaurs, including the dreaded Velociraptor and spitting Dilophosaurus of Jurassic Park fame. I mean, I literally have to pull this stuff off with a straight face, which is easier said than done. You know, it's also sad because I have to deal with the PR departments of a lot of these corporations and see the microcephalics that are getting cranked out by our educational system. It's scary stuff, you know. It's scary stuff. But so that's one of my schemes, is to free myself up to be a full-time anti-fascist researcher so that I can make a positive contribution to the succeeding generation so that it will not be plunged into an abyss and made more sinister by the Knights of Perverted Science, et cetera, et cetera. And hopefully things will...